Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
Ladies and gentlemen, this QLS classic we're about to present is one of my personal favorites. That's right, my personal favorites. You know, I always say if you want to know about your favorite artists, you kind of got to get in with their circle. Well, this Greg Film Games episode is an amazing example. His Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, and Quincy Jones stories are gold. Solid gold. This is one of my top 10 of all-time QLS episodes. It's funny, informative, dramatic, and amazing. Here it is, the Greg Film Games QLS Classic, Part 1. All right, here we go. Hit it. One, two, three.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Film Games is the man.
Yeah.
Hits on the shelf.
Yeah.
But on Michael's Don't Stop to Get Enough,
yeah.
Did that bridge just write itself?
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Yes.
Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
And I'm a winner.
Yeah.
With Filling Games.
Yeah.
Now let it simmer.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
I got the sugars.
Yeah.
I'm having significant pains.
Yeah.
But I'm making significant gains.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Sunshine.
Yeah.
Moonlight.
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah.
Blame it on a boogie.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Oh, damn. I said it's all
that. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
It's like E.M.
Yeah.
And I can't help it.
Yeah.
Greg Filligames.
Yeah.
The reason you felt it.
Roll call. Suprema.
What would Hope say?
Roll call. Suprema.
Why you brown, Greg?
Suprema roll call.
My name is Greg.
Yeah.
I'm with Amir.
Yeah.
But I can't believe that he's right here.
Roll call. What? Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, I am right here.
Wow.
What's up, y'all? Welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. We are live at United Recording Studios, the legendary United Recording Studios. I believe that this is where Frank Sinatra and many
Man's
World recorded here too.
The other room in here, yeah.
Yes, yes. We're in the legendary, legendary United Recording Studio.
Ray Charles.
Wow. Yeah. Let me just let the QLS listeners know that our guest today always accuses me of putting my nerddom for useless music trivia information ahead of our friendship.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I will start off before I even start the introductions. I will just start with Greg Film Games. How are you today?
Amir, I'm just fine. And it's so good to see you at the beginning of 2018.
Yes, it's great to see you too. All right, so ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Questlove Supreme. Our guest today is one of the heaviest heavyweights of musicians and producers and arrangers. This is the man that you call when you want the special sauce, or as Marlon Jackson said, now it's soup. I've never heard that term in my life, but he said, when we got Filling Games involved, now it's soup.
Wow. He said that?
Yes, he said that.
He says a lot of wacky things.
Well, I kind of understood what he meant. And, you know, your presence on, you know, when you read some of our favorite records and productions of the last 40 years, your name is always involved on some of the most life-changing albums that we've experienced. And we want to welcome Greg Film Games to Questlove Supreme.
That's very kind of you. Yes. You know why I love you, Amir? Because you're such an intense nerd about this and curator of this, but you're keeping the history alive, but you're doing it
in the creepiest way possible.
No, seriously. All jokes aside, you're doing it in the absolute best way possible. You're making it fun. You're using your platform from your celebrity to do this, and I for one really appreciate it, 'cause I don't get out very often these days, because I'm older now and I have twin boys who are almost three. They'll be three in April.
That's
a whole, and my 12-year-old daughter. But you know, I'm older now, and you know, it's a new day and it's a new world out there, and you know, I'm just trying to stay with it. So I appreciate.
But the thing is that you've made some of the best graffiti that will never ever be replaced, no matter what. And even if people don't know, like, it's there. Like, it's no erasing the history.
Well, I've been very, very blessed in that way. And it's true. I've always said, you know, my whole career, those that know, and those that don't. And it's fine with me. And actually, I kind of prefer it that way, because I love, this happens to me all the time. You know, I'll be talking to someone who has no clue of who I am, right? And they go, so you play, you're a musician? I go, yeah. Oh, what do you play? Keyboards? Oh, you in a band? I said, well, I've been in a couple bands, but you know,
stunning.
And I mean, I loved it. And I have this thing playing in my head. Like, I was at this incredible museum the other day called the Nethercutt Museum. It's over in Sylmar, and the curator of all these incredible musical instruments. Actually, Amir, you should see it, because it's unbelievable. Uh-huh. One of the things on display was an actual gramophone. And I mentioned to the guy, I said, well, you know, you can explain to the tourists there that gramophone is, you know, where the term Grammy came from, you know, the Grammy Awards, you know. He says, yeah, you're absolutely right. He says, you ever been to the Grammys? It's really fun. And so I have this thing, when I get asked a question like that, this vision runs through my mind of, like, you know, different times that I've MD'd the Grammys, like, you know, like for the Lionel Richie segment or the Aretha
outrageous
segment. And so these
outrageous
things go through my head before I answer the question going, yes. I've been there a few times, but I never explained that bit. I just go, yeah, I've been a few times. And it's hysterical.
You acknowledge it? Because I just try to throw off the scent. Like, yeah, I hear that a lot, but no, you know.
Well, sometimes I do that too, you know. But it's always fun engaging in those conversations and still leaving the people not having a clue of who I am. I love that.
No, but you never once been like, yo, hear that intro on We Are the World?
Yeah. Yeah, no, you know? No.
Nothing? No. Oh, okay.
No.
So
some things are better left.
Actually, you're my favorite type of person to interview, because often...
Oh, you just said that to Quincy the other night.
No, but I'm going to say what's weird is that often when people are in the eye of the storm or inside the tornado, they really can't give you a good perspective. And I'm saying that he has great stories, but for me, talking to engineers is way better than talking to, like,
the guy.
Really? I'd rather talk to Susan Rogers about Prince's work habits than Prince himself. You know what I mean? That sort
okay,
of thing.
Right, because you'll get that.
Yeah, that you'll get a different
outside perspective. Exactly.
Right. And I feel as though you're probably the best eyewitness to some crazy historic shit. I mean, just between Songs in the Key of Life and Thriller and... I mean, the list
you can
goes
stop up right there. Like, that's, that's the average person's whole shit. Like, that God.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, I'll give you that.
So, where are you originally from?
Detroit.
You're from the D.
I'm from the D.
East side or west side?
Well, it started in Highland, like, you know. Listen to Highland.
No, dude.
He's a nerd. All right.
Some of my, you know, some of my key records were created in Detroit as well.
Like, I did not know that.
I'm a lover of Detroit.
Okay, well.
But I know that people from the west side sometimes front and tell me east side for some credibility.
Right.
So I wanted to know, were you east side or west side?
Well, first of all, I don't need cred.
Okay. See, I already know you're west side, because you didn't even say what up, though, to me.
No, what up, though. You know, no, actually, I started in Highland Park, if you know about that, which virtually doesn't exist anymore. Sadly.
Right.
And then I moved to the northwest side.
Okay.
By 8 Mile.
Okay.
All right.
I see.
Yeah.
So your credentials there, are still there. You're in there.
Yeah.
Oh, side note, when you read the Purple Rain liner notes,
mm-hmm.
Prince actually gives a what up though.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Really?
He That's gives funny. A what up though to Billy Sparks.
From Detroit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, from Detroit. So are you, as far as your era or your period of growing up, mm-hmm. we've also interviewed Ray Parker Jr. on the show, so.
Oh, Lord, how did that go?
It was amazing.
Oh,
it was amazing.
Yeah.
He was the best.
How did you manage to leave?
Because we didn't want to.
No one loves talking about themselves more than Rex.
True.
I promise you that, man.
Damn, shots fired already.
No, man, I mean, I love Ray, but he knows. He knows. It's like, you know, you sit him down and you go, oh, you want to hear more about me? Great.
Nah, man.
Later that same week, you want to hear more? You
know. He makes it entertaining. But he basically said that from Stevie's Music of My Mind period up until Fulfilling This First finale,
mm-hmm.
he basically wanted, you know, all Detroit cats and his crew as his band. And I didn't know if that was just a preference of the something in the water in Detroit, or he just wanted to make sure that all the homeboys on the block got gigs or that sort of thing. But you're significantly younger, though, so how did you come to his attention?
I don't know. Oh, really? You don't know the story?
Nah.
Okay, well, settle back and I'll tell you the whole thing.
Yes, that's what we want. Fireside chats with Uncle Greg.
With Uncle Greg, yeah. Well, hello, kids. Let me tell you about it. So this is what happened. It's a year after I graduated. I'm in Detroit. I graduated high school, which was Cass Tech in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very excited and very much looking forward to going to college because, you know, that's just what you did. And I you know, it was like straight out of the Charlie Brown comics. You know, I got my little Joe Cool briefcase and I was like, I'm going to college.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Wayne State and I gradually just started sucking at everything, even the subjects I liked. Like, I really liked psychology. Sucking.
Wait, you weren't there for music?
It was a liberal arts. I took a liberal arts because I was lazy and I didn't want to, you know, really commit to anything. So I took a liberal arts course, and one of the courses was psychology, and I was really into it, but I sucked. I just could not get it together, you know. And so I remember telling my mom that, you know, college just wasn't working out, and she says, well, you know, just give it another chance and see what happens. And I was gaining a lot of notoriety in Detroit from playing in a couple of different bands fairly regularly and playing around town. And I absolutely idolized Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Stevie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had posters of him in my bedroom wall, and I really internalized, I really absorbed his music. I was to his music what you are to music in general. I mean, I just nerded out, but not in a cerebral way like you. More of an organic, spiritual, musical way, you mm-hmm. know. And I mean, I really connected with his approach musically and vocally, even though I was really shy about singing, I would sing with him in the shower or whatever, you know. And, you know, I was just mesmerized by his covers of other things, his arrangement. I mean, how do you go from Drive It My Way to, you know, We Can Work It Out.
Right.
We Can Work It Out. I mean, who does that?
Right.
And not to mention the intro. Who does that on a clavinet?
Right.
So I was mesmerized, right? I remember telling friends of mine in high school that I would eventually play with Stevie Wonder. I don't know why I did that. I don't know where that came from. Well, actually, I do. It came from the Lord because he put that dream in me, and I remember just spewing it out, like telling people I was going to play with him. So here's what happened. A dear, dear, dear friend of mine, who's a drummer, was asked to audition for Steve in New York by a former band member, by a former Wonderlove band member. He got to my friend and asked him if he'd be interested in auditioning for Stevie in New York. So the obvious answer was yes. The night before he left, the night before my friend left, I went to see him because I was just so thrilled for him. And, you know, he's packing and, you know, we're talking and we're all excited and everything. But he insisted that I play some things on a cassette. And he would give that cassette to Steve. This is the kind of friend he was. So he insisted I do this. So I played some things. But I remember one of the things I played was You Are the Sunshine of My Life.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
But I played it the same way he did on the record to kind of let him know I understand
a student. Yeah.
Right, how he thinks. And I played some other things, including Sun Goddess. I remember playing that. And I played like maybe one or two other things. And then my friend took the cassette and flew to New York the next day. And it seemed like time stopped. I don't know how long he was there, but I remember one day, maybe 2-3 days later, my friend called me early in the morning and said, Stevie Wonder wants to see you in New York today.
Wow.
Exactly. So I'm running around the house screaming like a banshee. It's like, and my mom is like, you know, she's on her way to work. You know, she was working at a hospital as a director of nurses. And she said, boy, what's the matter with you? West Indian, you know. What are you doing? So I said, Mom, Stevie wants to see me in New York. So she's like, well, just bring clean underwear. Because no matter what, no matter how bad of an accident you get, if you die, the first thing your mother's going to ask, was his underwear where then he stands? That's all they want to know. So but I'm asked to go to New York that day, but I'm also asked to stop by Stevie's house to pick up one of his brothers. So now I'm sitting inside Stevie Wonder's, and I knew where he lived. There were many of us that knew where he lived.
Right.
But now I'm sitting inside the house going, okay, well, I'm just here sitting inside Stevie Wonder's house. All right, I'm just waiting for one of his brothers to come down, and we're going to go to the airport. All right, let me just absorb this right now. So Timothy comes down, we go to the airport. Now, there are a few backstories. Now, the first backstory is, remember I was telling you how I was sucking in college? Mm-hmm. And Mom said to give it one more try. And I remember saying to myself, all right, look, I'm going to try this one more time. And I'm going to, if nothing earth-shattering happens, I'll register for the spring quarter on the last day to register.
Okay.
The day I was leaving for the airport to meet Stevie in New York was the final day to register for Wayne State.
Wow.
Look at God. And I remember being on, you know, going to the Metro Airport and it started snowing, you know, and it's just like, and it was April 1st.
Oh, wow.
On top of all that. So, fly to New York, get settled at the hotel, go to the studio. I'm sitting on pins and needles because I realize I'm about to meet my idol that I'd only seen twice in concert before. And I'm getting ready to meet this guy, like face to face. And I'm really trying to be cool. The engineer is just like, you know, we're making small talk, but I'm just.
Your hands sweating.
Everything is just, I'm really just.
Is this at the record plant?
This was at the Hit Factory.
Oh, okay.
The original one.
Okay.
With one elevator and the
54th
right?
Street, yeah.
Right, 54th.
The Mariah Carey Boys and Men elevator.
There you go. And also known as the Greg Fillinganes elevator, because I have a story about that particular elevator.
Later. Word?
Yeah, I do. Okay. It'll crack you up. but anyway, so I'm waiting on Penn State. Finally, elevator door opens, and you know, because you're in the studio and there's a monitor there's a camera that's pointed at the elevator to see who goes in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Elevator door finally opens in. Out he comes. He, you know, thing. And his sister Renee is towing him, and he's just he comes in, and I go, "Oh my God, there he is!" So we walk, because you know that's what you do.
Yeah, it is.
That is what you do. You don't say, but this is what's going on in your head. Like, so you know, and he's coming in, and so they say, "Steve, Greg's here," and so he. How you doing? And that handshake, that single handshake was the thing that changed my life. We, from that point on, we made small talk and, you know, he actually showed me an original unreleased song of his and he wanted to see if I could play it.
What was it called?
I see. Of course. Well, well, there's an answer for that, Amir. And it was called Spring High.
Oh, he ended up cutting it on Ramsey Lewis.
You're good.
Mm-hmm. I told you we
You're
were
good, you. You're good. You're good, you. You over there. You're good.
Wow, okay.
I've seen good. You're one of them. So, yes, but, you know, at some point, you know, early on, he said he was going to give it to me. But, you know, I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter because I know and love Ramsey, and it was fantastic. So that's the first song I learned.
Wow.
How about that? That was the first song I learned.
Oh!
Huh? Right? Come on, you know it, Steve.
I didn't read my credits, but I know this song very well.
Yeah.
We had the A-track, so there were no credits.
Oh,
the
A-track. Okay, okay.
Yeah, yeah. No,
but when you think about it, how about that chorus that goes...
This is so great.
Right? So there, you know, too bad I don't have a keyboard. Anyway.
Don't say that.
But yeah, so that was the first one I learned. Now, that's the night of April Fools.
Mm-hmm.
Next day is more of the formal audition.
Wait, one quick question.
Yes.
This is 1975?
This is 1975.
So Songs in the Key of Life did not come out yet?
No. He was still working on it.
75, okay.
Okay, 75. Next day is more of the formal audition. It's between me and an older-looking white guy, which I came to find out later on, much later on, years, years later, that guy was sent to audition by Chick Corea.
Wow.
Because Chick heard about Steve auditioning, and he sent this guy... And wait a minute. His name, Mike Garson.
Okay.
And the reason why I know this is because it was just like maybe a few years ago, this guy approached me at the NAMM show in Anaheim and said, "I know you, but you may not know me." I go, "Why?" He says, "'Cause I'm the one that auditioned against you for Wonderlove." I go, "You've got to be kidding me."
What?
Mike Garson, and he told me the whole story from his side. He told me that Chick Corea sent him, and I'm like, "You've got to be kidding." So I put his name, you know, my contact list, and there's a picture of us, you know, standing side by side, but there's another picture of me going like, "You're the one, you're the one." choking his neck, right? So so it's between me and Mike, you know, and we're at Bill's rehearsal hall. I remember Bill's. You don't know about that?
No.
Okay, it was called Bill's.
I was fourth, but...
Okay, fine, all right.
Okay.
So, it's a place called Bill's, and I met everybody in Wonderlove, including...
Ollie? Raymond?
Raymond and oh my... Niecy.
Okay.
Niecy. And Niecy was very, very precocious. She would, you know, run up to me... From time to time, it pinched me on the butt. I'm going through the process, and from time to time, different band members would come up to me on the side and go, "It's okay, you got it. Don't worry about it. It's all right. Don't worry. It's fine." And so, and I'm still a little nervous, but I don't even remember what I did.
What song was it?
I have no idea. We were playing all day. I have no idea. I don't remember anything about it. I just remember going through the process and playing with everybody and kind of, you know, feeling my way through, and this other guy, Mike, you know, and that was that. So after that whole day, back in the car with Steve, it's evening time now. We're on our way back to the Hit Factory. I'm in the back, Steve's in the front, and he turns around at one point and goes, "So, How does it feel to be a member of Wonder Love? So, in my head, I'm thinking, is he serious? I don't know. Because now all these things are coming back to me about like how I heard he was a practical joker and he never, you know, all these things, right? So I wasn't sure. So I said, are you serious? He goes, of course I'm serious. I went, oh, really? So now I'm trying to think, how can I prove this? How can I prove that? So I said, well, would you mind telling my mom? Because yeah. She's not going to lie to mom.
That's the original mom. Instagram.
Okay. The original Instagram is mom. So, you ain't going to lie to mom. So he says, sure. So we get to the studio. I dial the house and give him the phone. The first voice my mom hears is Stevie Wonder's telling her that he wants to have her son in his band and he'll take care of him and he thinks he's very talented and this and this and this and this and this. And they talk for a couple of minutes and then he has the phone back to me. And for the next few minutes, this is what you hear. So,
damn, you made it.
Yeah.
Like at that moment, did you feel like that your mother's response? That's the first time you ever probably got that.
Well,
like that.
We were doing that to each other. I was just screaming. But the thing is that, you know, she thought, because she told me later on, she thought that it was just going to be a weekend fling and I was going to, you know, meet him and have a little thing and then come back home.
Come back and go to school. Yeah.
Well, it was a weekend fling. I did meet him and I did go back home to get the rest of my shit.
She was happy that's a music thing to make you some money.
So you were 19.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and that's the punchline. It was a month before my 19th birthday, but it was a month before Stevie's 25th.
Okay.
Let's say that again. A month before Stevie's 25th birthday, which means he was working on songs in the key of life at 24.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. That is crazy.
So when he... after he turned 25 was when that was released. 25.
Wow.
I was still trying to learn how to tie my shoelaces at 25. This guy, songs in the key of life.
Wow.
So let that marinate.
Yeah, you put it in perspective.
Yeah.
Because I... wait, there's something I want to ask you about your Stevie experience.
I have two other backstories.
No. Okay.
But ask before you finish.
Well, see, now I'm asking for another backstory on Stevie. No.
Okay.
I'd rather you go.
Okay. All right. Finish. So here's the thing. Thing is, my dear friend, the drummer, did not get the gig.
I was wondering. Okay.
Who was he?
Well, unfortunately, you have to ask in that, you know, in that grammar, you have to say was because.
Oh. Ricky.
Ricky Lawson.
Ricky. Oh, no. Ricky Lawson.
Wow. Ricky.
Oh.
You have not experienced friendship until Ricky Lawson was a friend of yours.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Ricky Lawson was the very definition of friend in every aspect. I mean, you know, you hear, there's a line that goes, he'll give you the shirt off your... Mm-hmm. Yeah. He literally would give you the shirt off his back.
Wow.
There's story after story after thousands of stories about how he impacted people's lives just quietly, and he was the sweetest guy ever, and there will never be another Ricky Lawson.
Dennis used to talk about
you
him
told
all the time.
You told this story on Soul Train. You're the first cat I knew that didn't even talk about your album. It was a tribute to Ricky Lawson. I was like, this is the weirdest thing I've
really
like, usually have. You got 2 minutes to sell your product to Don. Yes, yeah, a new album, and this is my single. And Don asked you like, well, tell us about your beginning. He just said, it's all because of this man right here. And it was like, it was almost a tearful moment. I was like, wow, like, damn, I got to treat the Roots better.
But wait, so can you tell the drummer story then? Because Ricky didn't get the gig, but I know Dennis used to talk about Ricky all the time.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Well,
so.
Dennis Davis. But it turned out that Steve was just trying to, I don't know, intimidate or strike fear into the, but it, actually the drummer that was there was Raymond Pounds.
Raymond Pounds, yeah.
So that's who I met. But Ricky didn't get it with Steve, but Roy Ayers was hanging around a lot at the time, and Roy said, if you don't get it with him, you got it with me. So he ended up with Roy. And technically,
which is weird,
because no, Dennis was with Roy and Stevie.
Yeah.
And but Dennis and Ricky were like really close.
Yes. So it was a lot of incestual action going on there.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. So technically, even though I just joined Steve's band and I was working on Songs in the Key of Life, technically the first album that was released that I'm on is Everybody Loves the Sunshine.
Roy had me on that.
Yes.
That's you?
Yeah, it's me. Not on everything. I think on two songs. But there's one song that I have a solo on at the end that I was just blazing, and I was very young and crazy and hungry, and I was just like, rah! You know. So yeah, that was the first thing that was released that I'm on.
What equipment were you using at the time?
Whatever the hell I wanted to.
What was out back?
I was working with Stevie Wonder, dude. He had two of everything.
Well, I'm just saying that now, you know, we get a Korg, we get a, you know.
No, cousin, these... No. First of all, I had several pristine Rhodes.
That's what I want to know. Like,
okay, I mean, like Rhodes like you cannot believe. Like Rhodes like the intro to Superwoman Rhodes. Oh, I mean, right. I'm like Rhodes, right?
Right.
And we had the Yamaha stuff, the CS80, the ARP 2600, the Mini Moves.
Yeah.
And of course, the Dream Machine.
Tonto?
No. You know about the Dream Machine. This is
Synclavier?
No. It's way before Synclavier. This is what Synclavier was trying to be like.
What someone black man, that little automated?
No. No. This is a custom keyboard from Yamaha. Three-tier keyboard, all white and chrome, and the speakers are about as tall as I am. And for those of you who don't know, that's like 5'8".
Six so, feet. Just say 6 feet.
Nah, yeah, right? No, 5'7", 5'8", on a good day. But they're tall. They're beautiful speakers. And I have beautiful, fond memories of sitting next to Stevie, just the two of us, wagging our heads together, playing the parts to Saturn.
Wow.
And playing the string parts to Joy Inside My Tears. Just the two of us. On
wow.
That. Okay? That's just a couple of things. And then, and there are, I believe, four of these in the world. Of course, Steve owns two of them. And they're not cheap. And they're not even in production anymore. They stopped, years ago. But, incredible instrument. And so, yeah, I mean, I had, my clavinets and all that other kind of stuff.
So let me ask, if usually in a musician's life, I mean, they're just a sponge when, you know, if they discover music early from like 10, 11, 12, you know, they're a sponge, they're open to anything.
Yeah.
Usually your first taste of maturity comes when you're like 15, 16 years old, when you start like putting away childish things and something affects you. Can you tell me, I like to hear the accounts of people when they first discovered Music of My Mind. Did that album have an effect on you as far as like a...
Huge.
Whoa, what is this?
Huge.
See, because I love it so much, but of course I was born in 71, so me discovering it in 1979 is way different than being there in real time listening.
Yeah.
What was that moment like to hear those patches and those like that?
Well, it just made me realize that he was a visionary when it came to creating sounds that accurately described his feelings.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing way he used the new technology of that time to essentially orchestrate. Because, you know, when you hear things like, again, Superwoman, and his use of those high synths and everything, and how he combined, the newer instruments with traditional instruments like piano, drums, and so forth. So, and of course, the songwriting, every aspect of it, the songwriting, the vocal approach, the level of musicianship, because, you know, let's remember, he played everything. And so that had a huge effect. But, you know, it was a gradual progression, because I didn't just get into him at Songs in the Key of Life, cousin. It was like, you know, from Everybody Say Yeah. It was from that. But then, you know, just going along the ride, the journey with him, the progression, you know, from Fingertips to
Where I'm Coming From.
Yeah, even before, before that, like Signed, Sealed, Delivered, Please, you know, the cover of We Can Work It Out, Shooby-Doo-Da-Day, you know.
I'd Be a Fool Right Now.
Yeah, I Met Your Match, you know, things like that. And then from that, slowly crossing over into the more mature era, you know, starting with Where I'm Coming From, which was, of course, a precursor to Music of My Mind. And Where I'm Coming From kind of doesn't get enough credit, because Where I'm Coming From had a couple of gems like I Never Dreamed You'd Leave This Summer. Let's not forget that.
Soldier.
Okay,
Think
exactly.
Soul, yeah.
Sugar.
And
that was Sign, Sealed, Delivered.
Take a Course in Happiness, you know.
Isn't that a song on?
No, Sugar's Sign, Sealed, Delivered. Sign, Sealed, Delivered, album before.
Oh, Do Yourself a Favor. Educate Your Mind, you know. So get yourself together, you know. So all that kind of stuff. And so going along that journey and then ending up at the beginning of the five great album era, starting with songs with Music of My Mind, because the reason why I call it that is because there were five albums that were completely great, where every song was great. There are other albums before and after that had great songs, but not complete. Music of My Mind was a complete great album. Inner Visions was a complete great album.
Talking Book
was a complete great album.
Fulfilling This First Finale
was a complete great album, and we won't even discuss Songs in the Key of Life. So that's five right there. That five album run, by the way, that ended at 25.
Wow.
Just reminding you that. Because he was 25 when Songs in the Key of Life was released.
Oh, that's right. So
right.
Before that, damn.
Exactly. That's the perspective. But can I just give you one last backstory about...
Give all the backstory. Okay. We live for that shit.
Okay. So I was given another perspective years later by one of Steve's former managers, who explained from his end how the process went down for my audition. So Ricky goes to the studio and he auditions and he's told he doesn't get the gig. He kind of leaves with his tail between his legs, you know, and he's like obviously disheartened, and he leaves the studio. He's outside the studio. He feels in his pocket and he remembers that my cassette's in his, that he still has my cassette. He goes back to the studio and says to one of the managers at the time, listen, you know, I got this friend, his name is Greg, and you know, I promised him that I'd give this tape to, he's a keyboard player, and I promised it I'd give this cassette to Steve so he could check him out. Would you mind just making sure he gets it? And the guy says, sure. Puts it on a table with a pile of other cassettes. Steve was not there at the time. Mm-hmm. He stepped away. Some time later, he comes back. He sits down at the table with the cassettes. He's fishing around, and all of a sudden, he
just grabs one at random.
Grabs one at random. Sticks it in. Presses play. He's listening. And then he stops wagging his head because he's got like a kind of disconcerted look on his face. And he sits still and he goes, he takes the cassette out and goes, what's this say? So the guy says, Greg. And of course, he butchered my last name. And so Steve reportedly said, get him.
Wow.
So because apparently... Well, no, I'll get to that in a minute. So they call Ricky back. They see Ricky, and he goes, "Oh, did he change his mind?"
Well,
not exactly, but you know your friend. Can you call him?
Oh,
damn.
Okay,
damn, Ricky.
So I know, right? So that's what. But then the reason why Steve reacted the way he did, apparently, legend has it, is because he thought it was him.
Wow.
Oh.
He thought it was him playing, and he couldn't quite figure it out. Wow. I guess I left a bit of an impression, which is kind of what I wanted to do. So that's...
Damn.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
It's bananas. And I actually remember telling Steve that, like, maybe like a couple years ago. And he said, all right, well, that sounds... Yeah, we'll go with that. He didn't...
We'll go with that.
That's right.
So you were just auditioning to be in the band, but... You wound up on Songs in the Key of Life.
4 times.
So, okay, being in the Eye of the Storm.
Yeah.
What, because I remember, like, now it doesn't seem like a year and a half was all that long to wait from 74 till 76.
Oh, but it was.
Yeah. And
it
yeah.
was if you're Barry Gordy.
Exactly.
Right, right.
So, one, what was taking so long, and why? Well, of course, I know that, you know, fine wine takes its time, but
There's fine wine, and then there's Stevie Wonder.
So by the time you're there, do you know that it's going to be a double album or 2.5 albums?
No, I just know it's a lot of
music. Did he know that?
I don't know. I don't know. It was just because for every one song that ended up on the record, there's about 3 or 4 that didn't.
Damn.
So you do the math on that. And
so how many songs do you think around during that period?
It's endless. Because you know what? I have a few cassettes of unreleased stuff.
Mm.
Yeah. Pretty sure I have two. And that's not even, you know, that's barely the tip of the iceberg.
Okay.
And that's from back then.
Okay.
You know, so it's added up over the decades. Yeah, he had a lot of stuff.
Question.
And he had things like you got to hear this story.
Okay.
Cuz it sort of it ties in with your question. All kinds of unreleased stuff. And the night before my first show with him, which was in D.C., for a little thing called Human Kindness Day, which was on the grounds of the Washington Monument, 250,000 people. That's my first show.
Oh, man. Whoa.
Yeah, there's an audition for you.
Yeah.
So it's the night before. And, you know, usually or traditionally, Steve would have a massive black bag full of tapes of guess what? So I somewhere found the, intestinal fortitude to ask him if I could borrow the bag. And do you know he said yes? Wow. What about that? I have, I'm 19 years old. I have barely 19. I have Stevie Wonder's bag of unreleased music in my room.
Wow.
With a pair of headphones. What are you going to do?
Stay in there for like a week.
Okay, yeah. So I'm just rifling through stuff. I can't believe he said yes to this day. And I'm playing stuff. And Amir, for the first time, I'm hearing the original version of Send One Your Love. And I cannot describe to you what it was like, Amir. All I can say was that it was an instrumental. And all the synthesizers were singing.
Ooh, what?
They were singing, Amir. Now, you know how it goes, you know, right? But in addition to the melody, they had these background synths going in harmony. I'm telling you, Amir, it was otherworldly. I never heard anything like it in my life. And I'm sitting there like, it was like LSD and the best weed you ever can think you can imagine. And I don't do drugs, but I'm talking about it was like all of those combined. It was just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
Shit.
And that's one thing I heard. And I heard all kinds of stuff that I can't even describe the feeling. And I gave it all back to him the next day. And I was a changed man.
God.
Wow. So none of this stuff has ever come out, the outtakes from Songs in the Key of Life or the demos and all that?
No, he had another...
Does it exist? I mean, is it going to come out?
I don't know. I have no idea. But there's another... Oops. There was another song called Living for Your Love. And I think he has since released that, but the original version of that was the best. And that was done on the Dream Machine, too, and all these weird sounds and boom, 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 boom. Whoop, whoop, do, 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 whoop, whoop, do, 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 whoop, do, 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 whoop. I mean, just crazy stuff, you know.
And so the original Sin When You Love, that was, I mean, the version you heard was what, 75, 76? Was it that early?
75.
Sounds about right.
75, man.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Usually when we get stuff, especially it's that good.
It's been
watered down. It's been cut a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
God.
Yo, so, you know how amazing the version would be for that to just...
Oh, my God.
For him to leave it off the record like, yeah, not yet.
Yeah, 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 that one. And so the one you know about...
Yeah.
Doesn't hold a candle.
Doesn't even compare.
Wow. Man. Doesn't even hold... You think you like that?
Yeah.
Wow. So, I got to know, why did he part ways with the Tonto guys? With Bob and Malcolm.
Yeah, Bob and Malcolm. I don't think it was anything. I think it was
Well, they were there in the program.
Well, I mean, they introduced him to the whole world of synths with Tonto. And I think it was just time to change. Yeah, I don't think it was anything, negative. I don't really know much about the split, but I don't think it was anything... You know, I don't think it was because of any issues.
Well, you know? I didn't mean like was it amicable, but yeah. I was just trying to figure out if, you know, for what they were doing with him between 71 and 74, with you know, synthesizers were the size of rooms.
Yeah.
Suddenly, Yamaha's making these. Because what I want to know is the ability to play chords with these patches.
Yeah.
And what year was it that you were able to play more than one note at the at
Polyphony?
The same time?
Well, that kicked... Oh, I can't remember the exact year, but it was kind of going on when I was there because of the Dream Machine and because of the CS-80. You had Polyphony with those instruments. But I think as far as the split from Malcolm and Bob, it just seems to me, thinking about it, that he wanted a more hands-on approach, and he was able to do, he felt he could do more on his own with the technology of that time, because, you know, you got the ARP 2600 now, and, you know, but that was around even during, before Songs in the Key of Life, because that was on, it was the bass sound for Boogie On. So, I mean, that it was around, but I just think he wanted to take more of a hands-on approach and just create the sounds on his own.
So what songs are you on as far as the actual tracking?
Right. So Saturn.
Okay.
Contusion.
And the only reason why I'm on Contusion is because that crazy line that Mike Cimbello came up with, he couldn't play it. And I said, well, I can. So he said, okay, go. So in the bridge, that's me doubling
Michael.
Oh,
the inside line?
Yeah, that's me. That's me doubling Michael on a synth. Yeah. And that's the only reason why I'm on that. And then probably.
Isn't She Love Me?
My favorite, one of my favorites for sure. Well, yes, Isn't She Lovely? I'm on that. And one of my favorites for sure, Joy Inside My Tears.
Mm, yes.
The string parts of that. So, and I play the Rhodes on Isn't She Lovely?
Man.
Yeah.
So were those songs all tracked together with a group of people?
No. Isn't She Lovely was an overdub. I definitely remember that. But I also remember meeting the subject of that song in a little crib at his brownstone in New York. And I remember going upstairs and looking down on the crib and going, oh, she's cute. but yes, it was a Rhodes overdub on Isn't She Lovely. It was kind of like, Well, it was an overdub on Contusion as well. Mm-hmm. Steve and I did the string parts and the orchestral parts together on Joy Inside My Tears and Saturn.
So when the album comes out in 76.
Yeah. By the way, he actually had t-shirts made up.
We're not done yet.
We're almost finished. Yeah. We're almost finished, yeah.
So Steve.
Yeah.
You guys were going to do that for Voodoo, weren't you?
They did.
Yeah,
do it,
we
yeah.
did. Because D'Angelo was taking 5 years with Voodoo. So
oh, yeah.
We
yeah. Too, you did the same
we
thing.
Did our, yeah. yeah, I made yeah. t-shirts that, yeah. you know.
And you can still wear them today.
So
I do love that guy, though.
When in 76, in September of 76, when this comes out.
Yeah.
What was, I just recently found, have you guys ever seen that EPK that's online when the press is hearing Songs in the Key of Life for the first time? Have any of you guys seen this?
No.
So when you, like, Google Songs in the Key of Life EPK, and it's like a listening session of,
really?
Of yeah, like, 50 key rock critics, even like Robert Christgau is there when he was in like his younger days, but they're all listening together and to watch them collectively jaw drop, like
really?
After they hear Sir Duke for the first time. And you know, it's one of the coolest things I've ever seen, really? But yeah, it's on YouTube. But
or YouTube, okay,
to watch right. people, well, that you know, like I was in first grade by the time it came out, and what was it?
Oh my God.
September? Was no, my
first
my homework.
Grade.
No, homework.
Man, I've got socks older than you. It's in first grade.
Yeah, like my homework was, you know, have mom and dad buy this album, and you know, we all had our copies in school the next day, and we're reading the liner notes and all this stuff. No, even the liner notes alone like changed my life. But what was it? Just in real time and to tour behind this album, what
well,
was it
all,
like to?
Well, first of all, it wasn't. He didn't tour off of this.
Wait a minute, you sure?
Yeah, I'm kind of sure.
Because when he won his Grammy, he was like, "You guys remember that episode of the Grammy Awards where he was in Africa?"
Yeah, but that wasn't a tour. We went we went to Lagos, Nigeria. Because he wanted to perform down there, and it turned out to be, you know, in time, or during the Grammys, and we did a remote segment, and that's where you have Andy Williams asking the immortal question, Stevie, can you see us? Thank you.
Yo, that was the weirdest thing to watch as a 7-year-old.
No,
man.
He
was like on this telephone, but okay, that explains why he was dressed in all that African garb.
Yeah,
was Fela at those shows?
I think so. I don't remember. I don't remember, but I think so. I have kind of. I only have one memory of Lagos, but anyway. What it is? Well, that we rolled up and we stayed in this very opulent hotel, and it was like, you know, gold fixtures in the bathrooms and everything. And I remember I remember my room was high up, and I remember looking down on the beach and seeing people squatting on the beach and being in huts. I remember that. But it was wild, man. I also remember like the auditorium we actually performed at, you know, the crowd was great. They were raucous, you know, and I'm like, okay, we're doing a remote broadcast to the Grammys? This is crazy. But that's it. So we didn't tour off of that album. He didn't really do formal tours, just did one-offs like playing Jamaica and having Bob Marley open for us. That wow. didn't suck.
No, right. I'm sure it didn't.
You know, and I remember when we were rehearsing and he told us that we were going to Jamaica, like I immediately went out and got Marley's album, which was what was that Hallmark album? What was the name of that
Exodus?
Album? No, crap.
Catch Fire?
No, it had, I don't remember the name of the album, but it had, you know, Lively Up Yourself, and it had,
I'm looking.
Yeah, look, it's a class, you'll know when you see it. No.
Catch a Fire, Burning, Natty Dread.
Must be Natty Dread.
Okay.
Yeah. Roots, rock, rock, yay!
Okay, yeah.
That's music.
That's Rastaman Vibration, that one.
Okay.
Yeah, Roots rock
reggae.
Mm-hmm. That was 76.
Well, I remember, yeah, okay. So I remember getting that and just playing it over and over again. And then, like, next thing you know, Marley's opening up for us.
Damn.
It's crazy. So well, that and.
Why no touring, though?
Because he's Stevie Wonder. He's just different. He's just, you know, he's just all over the place. No, he was just all over the place. He
offer those album, like those songs, and that's so weird. I thought he didn't tour behind A Secret Life of Plants, but I definitely thought he toured behind.
He did? No. Oh. No. Like I said.
He did 5 days with Secret Life.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, my first gig was the Human Kindness Day in D.C., and I don't remember what happened consecutively after that, but I know Jamaica, you know, Lagos, and things like that. But not a lot of
action.
Not a lot of action. Not anything formal or consistent that you would you know classify as a tour.
But did he want you exclusively his? Because I'm trying to figure out exactly when did you ease to the Jacksons.
Well, we were all on retainer. And that was the other cool thing about being in the band. And it's like, I just turned 19, and I'm making $500 a week. And I'm like, okay, this is it. This is it right here. This is it. On retainer, like, every week. And
was that, okay, I'm so glad you said that.
What?
For a working musician.
Yeah.
Was that a good living in 1975, 76?
At that time, yeah.
Okay.
It was great for me.
Okay.
Yeah. Today, that's not even an hour for me.
Well, but, yeah, I know that, but you know, like your 500 back then today would probably be like, you know, 4,500 a week or something, but
yeah, something like that, but or at least 10 times as much as that, but no, it was great. So I was with him from 75 till the beginning of 79, January 79. The last cha-cha with him was in Atlanta. I remember that. And then it was tough to say goodbye. But I realized that I needed to, or else I was going to remain stagnant.
Yeah, it's going to be comfortable.
Yeah.
So and you had a goal to be a producer, or
no,
was it just
no,
like...
No, I had a goal to expand to the extent that I could, because... This was based on promises, unkept promises of, you know, producing an album on Wonderlove.
Everyone has that story.
Yeah, he kept promising us he was going to, do an album. And it got to the point where we believed him less and less. And then one day he said, all right, look, I'm doing this, and this is what we're going to do. We're going to go. We're going to leave here. We're going out of here, and we're going to Louisiana. I don't know how he found this place, but there is I don't even know if it still exists now, but there was, back then, a studio called Studio in the Country. Never more was there an appropriate name for a facility. Because this place was in Bogalusa, Louisiana.
Damn.
Because isn't it?
Thank you. Look that up, Google it. I don't even know if Bogalusa exists anymore, but it did then, and it was deep, deep, deep in the country. And
it was in a house?
No, it was a studio, and it was a cool studio too. it was a proper studio.
But
it was
how cool. Deep in the country in the late 70s?
Oh, it was deep. It was in the sticks, but it was great. The people were wonderful.
It's still open, by the way.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay, how about that? Studio in the Country in Bogalusa, Louisiana. We went down there and we hung out, and I have to tell you about my most memorable experience of being there, because you haven't lived until you've been in a car with Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, I was waiting for the car driving story, so hit it.
You haven't lived until you've been driven in a car by Stevie Wonder.
Whoa.
So but no accident.
No. So here's what happened. So we're feeling frisky. We're in the hotel, and, you know, we're just like... messing around, and all of a sudden, I don't remember who else I was with, but it was a small group of us, and somebody said, hey, Steve, you want to drive?
Mm.
I'm sure. So we go down, go to somebody's car in the parking lot. It was open. There were very few cars in the lot. And we all get in the car, And he gets behind the wheel and it's like,
is he having a time of his life?
He's cracking up. And whoever was sitting next to him was like, okay, go right, go left. He's like, okay. And it's hysterical. And we're just dying laughing. We're cracking up. And I go, okay, this is something to remember.
Yeah. Shit.
Yeah. Wow. So that was the most memorable thing, unfortunately, that happened. We made a good amount of music. We all took turns trying to be Junior Stevies. You know, I came up with a couple of songs that weren't really great, but, you know, whatever. And but then at one point, he left. Went to New York, and that was the beginning of the end. And he started phoning things in, and then all of a sudden, he just kind of left us to fend for ourselves. And I was like, okay, you know what? This isn't really going to happen. So I had to make up my mind, and it was a tough decision, but there were two times in my life when I felt spiritually depleted, and it was crucial for me to move, and that was the first time.
Man.
Yeah.
So what this was, so now, right at the beginning of Secret Life of Plants, or?
Well, let's see. No, because I was still in the band when he was working on that. Okay. I didn't play any, that was all him.
What was the, I mean, the general,
or mostly him, but
the general, what was the general conversation? Because, you know, usually with what they call the departure record,
yeah,
it's supposed to be seen as, yes, this is my artistic left turn and da-da-da-da-da. But I guess later in life, all of us here sort of discover that the departure record is kind of a means to ruin it before you get ruined, or it's the self-sabotage move. And
that's what you think Secret Life of Plants was?
Well, no, I mean, just most departure albums usually happen after your biggest album.
Right, right.
And you don't want to express the fear of you having run out of ideas or that sort of thing. So it's sort of like,
it's safe to do a soundtrack album.
Yeah, let me do the absolute left turn.
Trouble Man.
Yeah.
Trouble Man, but Around the World in a Day.
Right.
Sergeant Peppers. I mean, sometimes it backfires and
it becomes, right.
And becomes even bigger. So, I mean, for what was just the general movement? Like, hey, I'm going to do an all instrumental album. I know the world's waiting.
No, I don't think it had anything to do with that. I think you have to look at it like this. I think it had to do with wanting to take on the challenge of doing a score. This was a score to a movie done by a blind guy.
I didn't know that the movie was done by a blind guy.
The score. The score itself.
The score, a movie that he never saw.
It's a blind guy doing a score for a movie. Who does that?
Right. Well,
who does that?
I see.
So he...
Who hires that guy?
Well, somebody really crazy. Or somebody really... extra visionary. Mm-hmm. But I think he just dug the challenge. He was really into the challenge of doing it, and that was the premiere of Someone You Love. But he really got into it. He really got into the challenge and wanted to know as much about the movie, you know, as many details as he could get, and he just forced his entire being into that.
For the record, that's my favorite Stevie record. And so not to be contrary.
Really?
I mean, it's just, you know, I was 8 years old, and that was my Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon movie.
Okay.
Put the headphones on and close my eyes and imagine stuff. And
sure.
It just, like, I didn't know about, I have pop hooks. Like, my dad hated it. So he's like, here, you take it. And it just spoke to me as an 8-year old. So it.
That's pretty wild.
You know, actually, we're talking to him right now about doing some. Hopefully some dates, like, to do it in its entirety.
Secret Life of Plants?
Yeah, that's... Wow. Okay, did I just let the cat tool you?
All right, Quentin.
We won't hear this until after tonight.
Four words for you, bro. Good luck with that.
No, I mean, we're in the talking stage.
It's been, will be talking.
That's all you're going to be doing.
It's Solange's dream. It's our dream. So, I mean, that's basically
dreams can't come true, but I just, good luck with that.
I'll be calling you.
I was about to say, don't you need bread?
You'll need to.
Arms crossed, audience. Arms crossed.
So, was Destiny your first foray into arranging? And really, to me, it's producing. No. And like, why? Okay, we got to get into the titles of.
Yeah.
Because I only saw these credits on Jackson. Now I'm like, yeah. Finger Snap Arranger. Arranger. You know?
That's
like,
because they were all dying for credit.
Yeah, I get it.
Because they were so desperate to be on their own. And they just wanted to do, okay, look, I'm the one that set the mic. You know? I'm the one that chose the studio. Whatever it was.
Jacksons have the strangest album credits of all time that stuck with me for life.
Yeah.
So talk to me about you coming aboard for Destiny.
I will, but to answer the question, no, it wasn't my first foray into arranging because I was cutting my teeth. I was allowed to cut my teeth arranging-wise thanks to the partnership of Dick Griffey and Don Cornelius. Thank you.
Whoa. When you had to serve some time in Dick Griffeyville.
Yeah.
Soul Train Records.
Yeah.
No, don't you dare say Uptown Festival. Uptown Festival. Please don't say it. Shalimar's
Disco Garden.
No. But let me see. Did I do some Shalimar? I think
you did the Soul Train Gang album?
Oh, God, I don't remember that. But I remember working on different artists of theirs, of course.
I believe it.
Of course. Dick's
wife.
Muse.
Carrie Lucas.
Carrie. I did a couple of her albums. I did there was another there was another band. It was like two guys and they had sort of like an Indian name and I can't remember right now. But they had all these a small stable of artists including the Whispers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of stuff, and they just let me arrange.
No. Wait, you know what's weird? Mm. In your Wikipedia, it says that...
I know, Carrie Lucas is
your blood sister.
No, that is so... I don't know who... And they won't take it away. I don't know who to write to make that correction, but it's really annoying.
It doesn't matter, because one of the Dixie Hummingbirds was my grandfather.
Okay,
and
there
I
you go.
Got, you know, had to get embarrassed on national TV once. They told me, like, he's not your... grandfather.
Oops.
Yeah, exactly. So you did some time under Soul Train Records.
Yeah, but I enjoyed it. And I remember working a lot with the Whispers, and I remember one of the twins saying to me, you know what your problem is? I go, no. He goes, you know too much. I go, wow.
It was always some old
kind
of
cats
to say
a backhanded compliment. But, you know, yeah, he's like... Yeah, I didn't understand it then, but I sort of get it now.
Did you work on Let's Go All the Way?
Yeah.
Aha!
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when you're brought aboard, like what, were you there just for session work or like what was your title?
I don't really think I had a title. I wasn't like a staff producer or anything like that. I was just brought in to play sessions and sometimes arrange, either horns or rhythm or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I want to get to the Jacksons.
Okay, go. So, dear friend of mine, Bobby Columbi.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears, right? Okay.
The drummer who became an executive at CBS said, you know, you need to do more arranging. And I go, well, I don't know. I'm really sure. He says, no, actually you do. And here's who you're going to do it with. Next thing you know, I'm in a room with the Jacksons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, met all the brothers and, you know. Now, you have to remember the time. This was when they finally left the clutches of Motown. And this was after the Philly thing, you know. And so now they're trying to establish themselves as producers. But CBS was cautious. So they brought in Bobby just to make sure things didn't get too out of hand, you know.
Okay.
And so...
were you aware, I mean, was okay, dude, I mean, you were part of Songs in the Key of Life by then.
Yeah.
Like, was the Jacksons or Going Places on your radar by then? Or was it like, yeah?
Dude, no. I love the Jacksons. I had just as many dreams about them, just about as I had of Steve.
Okay.
Oh, no, absolutely, man. Because the thing, well, first of all, when I was eight and I saw the Beatles on Sullivan, I said, right, that's what I want to do. So the Beatles just changed my life. And then the Monkees changed my life because they were the American Beatles.
Right.
And then the Jackson 5 are the Black Beatles.
Right.
I'm like, this is fantastic. I mean, they even have their own cartoon show. What band do you know has their own cartoon show on Saturdays? This is fantastic. So I was all, you know, please, I want you back. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me right now? So it's like, yeah, I was all about the Jackson 5. And I had visions. I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be great if I could actually like meet them or work? It was incredible. Next thing you know, I'm in a room and here they are. And we're doing the Destiny album. And my first assignment was this little overly white bread tune called Blame It on the Boogie. And they played me the demo and I was like, Blame It on the Boogie. I'm like, okay, well, good. Let's see how we can funk this up. You
how
know?
Did they,
so,
the original did they find that?
Version is jamming, though. I like the original.
Did you like the original?
Mick Jackson.
Yeah.
Well, back then it seemed cutesy.
It was kind of white bread.
It works now because no one expects it when we spin it. Like, yeah. What the hell is that?
Exactly. But back then it was like, really? We're going to make this a Jackson thing? Okay. So
So Bobby brought that song to you guys?
I can't remember if Bobby brought it to them, but...
Were they open to it?
Well, actually, yeah.
Okay.
Generally speaking, yeah. But my mantra back then was, all right, I'm out here on my own. What would Stevie do? That was my thing. What would Stevie do? What would Stevie do? So, you know, and I would bring in like former band members to play on, you know, those early recordings. And so I'm always thinking, what would Stevie do? So it's like, all right, let's see. Gotta make it funky. So that's what, you know, that was the basis of that. And then, you know, things built from there. I didn't do the horn arrangements for that song, but they did turn out cool.
Was that Tom Tom or?
It wasn't Tom Tom, not yet. I don't remember who did the horns for that.
Okay.
But Tom Tom didn't come until later on. I mean, Tom Tom did. The horns for Shake Your Body Down. I mean, that was, you know.
Okay.
And by that point, they definitely wanted the Earth, Wind, and Fire influence, you know. So we got a little Tom Washington come in with his crazy stuff. I love Tom.
Okay.
But for Destiny, yeah, that was the first song. And then we just took it from there. And it was, you know, a marriage made in heaven.
So how do you even... approach, like, you're dealing with the five of them, but
yeah,
who's the alpha as far as like the music ideas? Who do you have to, like, who's the dad, who's the person that you have to get the idea from? Because I'm certain then it's like, well, I want my piece.
It was all of them. It was all of them in that way, you know.
But was it a psychological thing where it's like you had the Jedi mind trick and I don't like this arrangement. I don't like this song. And
in my mind, Jermaine was vocal.
He was gone.
He was gone. Okay, so Jackie was vocal.
No, Jackie was actually not as vocal. Certainly not as vocal as Jermaine. I think the main characters in that scenario.
Give me one second. Hang on.
Yeah.
Sorry. Hang on. I lost something. I found it.
Okay.
Loud and wrong. Right,
you know, I'm having so much fun right now. I want to do another one because you guys are wacky.
I mean, did Jermaine come around? I just, in my mind.
Stop asking.
All right, stop.
Jermaine Jackson, amateur questions.
You had the crush. Okay, all right.
More of a Marlin girl.
Let's see. Okay, so we had Michael.
Randy,
Marlon, Jackie, and Tito. Okay, so the most vocal were Michael, Marlon, and Randy. Randy was one of the more creative ones.
Okay,
for sure. And but all the ideas were just kind of run through the general pipeline between all of them. It wasn't. I don't remember it being as difficult as you might think. Well, but you know,
here's the thing, though. So the question
they generally love my ideas. You know,
so what was the division of labor like at working on Destiny? Like, who did what?
Oh gosh, well, a little foggy on the best way to answer that. They all kind of wanted to chip in. For instance, with Kenny Feel was on
Triumph,
right? Okay, yeah. So I gotta go to that album as an example. So Kenny Feel It specifically, I had, you know, several orchestral ideas. And one of them was like, you know, during the main part of the vamp, you know, dun, 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 dun. And so you got that thing going on, and then you got so I had it to where, you know, you'd have an orchestra chime boom, followed by a timpani. So you'd be like one, two, three, four, like that,
right?
Okay.
So you'd have that, you know, you'd have like one eighth note being the orchestra chime, and then the very next eighth note being the timpani. And so they, you know, we had one guy do the chime and another guy do the timpani. Everybody wanted to, you know, play a part in it. And it was cool, you know. So I would just answer by saying they all kind of wanted to do whatever they could that was reasonable.
Just to contribute.
Yeah.
Question about Things I Do For You.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it's 78, so All in All by Earth, Wind, and Fire is about a year old.
Mm-hmm.
How much did Jupiter have to do with that song? Because basically,
really?
Like, East, dude, 5 minutes later, 15 seconds later, like, literally the first verse and the bridge of Things I Do For You is like from the DNA of Jupiter by Earth, Wind, and Fire, of which, I mean, I can imagine that, you know, most songs, I mean, I even think that the DNA of Teddy Pendergrass's Get Up, Get Down, Get Funky, Get mm-hmm. Loose mm-hmm. was somewhat of a basis for Shake Your Body Down to the Ground.
Wow, you really get deep with this, don't you?
Well, I mean, the thing is, God,
it's frightening, isn't it?
It's frightening.
Yeah. But most songs...
I don't think of it that deep.
But the thing is that most songs are usually started with songs
something
that you
like. Mind.
There's a germ somewhere.
And then how can I twist it and make it my own?
I totally agree with that. I did not
think of it. Give it up. You know, being funk was all about. Let's dance. Let's shout. Getting funk was all about. Like, you know, that was out in 76. So I can imagine that the DNA of that stuff just being up in the air and them taking it.
Okay, well, while I never looked at it that way for that song, I do see your point. And to that point, it's very possible because I can tell you that they were highly influenced by EWF, as we all were, because for Heartbreak Hotel, they wanted the exact same bass sound from Fantasy. They wanted that. They specifically talked about that to the point where we brought in Verdeen.
Wow.
To try to have him duplicate it on. Right? And he couldn't.
Damn.
I mean, because we sat him down and asked him, what was that sound? And he was like, I don't know. I remember that. And I remember bringing him in.
I have my theory about Verdeen White, which I don't know if I want to break people's hearts, but.
What? No, I love Verdeen. You can't say anything bad. What?
Go ahead, finish your story.
Oh, no. Now we have to get back to that for sure.
Did you read Maurice's book?
No.
You got to read that, and you got to have some conversations with Phil Billy. I feel like there might be a Brian Wilson Beach Boys
Oh, okay.
parallel thing going on with the album version. And plus, if you start rapping to David also about his involvement in...
Yeah. Okay.
I don't believe they played on their records.
Okay, then.
You don't think he played on the records?
I don't think they played on their records.
You don't think EWF played on their records?
I don't think so.
Huh?
No, I got it. No. I gotta differ with you there.
Some things, but I've asked a lot of questions, and I feel like there's a Brian Wilson Beach Boys situation going on with Maurice and... Because even
you gotta get
in the middle of his book, because there was a lot of friction after once Charles Stephanie died.
Yeah,
then that's when Maurice sort of took the thing over, and then so who's this guy and why is he playing? And Roland Batista's back in the group. Wait a minute, Johnny Graham leaving. I'm opening up a super Pandora's box.
Okay,
go ahead, finish.
No pun intended.
This sounds man. I would really love to talk to you about this, like on the side.
That's really what the show's for.
You gonna get a beating.
No. I mean, like, out of interest, really.
Hey, Amir.
Yeah.
Do the Roots play on their records? On your records?
Oh.
Long story.
Oh.
No, but no, we just... Why do you think we went from a trio to, like, 11 people in the band?
Because you had to put... Yeah, okay. Yeah, you were on television.
Motherfuckers just joined. Like, initially, James was a ghosted player, but then it was like, dude, you're Billy Preston. You've been... James has been the Roots since... Illadelphia Half-Life.
But not necessarily Kamal on the record.
No, Kamal's on the record too. But I'm just saying that for a lot of the more complex shit, James has been there. So it's like,
All right, just wondering.
Yeah. Wait, were you trying to lie ear me on my own show?
Just saying, nobody is, immune.
Lord.
Get out of here.
So back to
this is great.
Earth, Wind, and Fire influences.
Yeah,
on
this is absolutely okay. So
you brought Verdeen.
I can't even believe I remember where I was. So we brought in Verdeen, and he wanted to do, and we couldn't get that thick sound that was like, in Fantasy, because they wanted to duplicate it for, Heartbreak Hotel, and it was close, but it wasn't. Actually, it wasn't even close. It wasn't that same sound from Fantasy, and we were slightly disappointed, but we used it anyway. So what was I going to say about that? Yeah. So I mean, to your point about that other, what was the song you brought up?
Things I do for you. To Jupiter.
It's possible. I just never looked at it that way, but it's an interesting take.
Well, also, you're in the thick of disco.
Yeah.
And I'm super shocked.
Yeah.
There's no Four on the Floor. I mean, the remix to Blame It on the Boogie was Four on the Floor enough with the little extra conga things. But you guys were obviously putting all of your eggs in the basket of Shake Your Body Down to the Ground.
Because I was going to say, what do you think that was?
But here's the thing, though. It's like, that was such... Not since 777-9311 have I heard a funk song in which the one, the two, the three, and the four are not even emphasized.
Okay, Amir, I have two words for you.
Hit me.
You're welcome.
Yeah, but it was...
You know I came up with the beat.
I know you did. That's why you're here.
Yeah, okay.
But it's like, it's 1978.
Yeah.
And disco is at...
It's flaming.
I mean, you guys were basically David to this Goliath moment.
I don't know.
Like, why did y'all decide to take that risk?
I didn't even look at it like that. I don't know if they did. I certainly didn't. My thing was, what would Stevie do? And I wanted to come up with something really cool.
And you wanted to go with funk and not disco.
That's how it spoke to me. So I wasn't thinking about disco. I was thinking about what would be the most effective way to make this long song remain interesting 6 minutes later.
Was there even a suggestion for a bridge or
no? No, because it was cool. We all knew that it was cool the way it was. I just wanted to give it something unique rhythmically that would drive it. My inspiration was Steve's unorthodox drumming style.
With the hi-hat and stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
So you were thinking, like, love having you around? Like, that whole, like...
Yeah, I was thinking, what would Stevie do? Yeah,
God!
I was thinking, what would Stevie do? So that's why I came up with... you know, the hi-hat, the toms, everything.
Yo!
And by the way, when we had Ed Green, the legendary session drummer, play, he couldn't play the whole thing.
I know.
He had to do it in three different... takes.
Okay, so when I heard the master,
yeah,
I heard the master of it,
yeah, okay,
and once I pulled the second and the third edition of the drums away and heard just a typical boot, I was like, oh, this is a normal drum break.
Oh yeah, no, what it was but just
why did
it
you,
was just that was the first take.
I heard that
right, and then the toms and then the hi hat.
So what was on your mind when you added those tom-toms and in such an odd spot?
Because I didn't add it. In my head, I was able to play the whole thing at once. So the entire thing was... So that's how I was hearing it. And that's but since he could only do one bit at a time, that's how we, you know, mapped it out. But for me, it was the whole rhythmic concept that I felt would work for the whole song.
That was not normal thinking, though.
Well, that's because I'm a keyboard player. I'm not
it wasn't normal. It's the equivalent. I'll explain that. It's the equivalent of, all right, if you go to a roulette table with $100 and then let's say like you got lucky and then you made 300 and you could just, you're walking away, you're in the parking lot. Greg basically did the rhythm version of, wait, I'll be right back. And he ran and just put everything on like one,
really
not even on all black, he just, I'm gonna play 42 and see what happens. And there's no really? 42 on roulette.
But he won.
He still won.
And wow. Won. It's Russian roulette.
Wow,
really? Is that how you look at it,
dude? Because it's like they got three chances. I mean, okay, the Jacksons was fine and they went gold and it was cute, and then you know the little summer series thing on CBS kind of sustained them.
Yeah.
But Going Places was like a decline, and I love that record still. But they needed
a hit.
Oh, yeah. They needed desperately.
They needed a miracle
for sure.
And this was Super Bowl Patriots versus the Giants.
Right.
With
crunch time.
Yes, I'm making a football reference.
I'm waiting
for me to mess up.
Yeah.
Well, you saw in the Super Bowl the last 10 seconds left, and the Giants just threw a Hail Mary pass.
Yeah.
And
look at you.
Okay. All right.
That's my first sports reference I got correct. No, dude, that's just amazing to me because.
Well, thank you. I wasn't really looking at it that way. I just, first of all, if I felt that kind of pressure, I'm sure I wouldn't have come up with that. But I mean, I just, you know, they played me the song and I thought, oh, it's so cool. Let's dance. Let's jump.
So you're not conscious of your genius.
No, stop that. I wasn't, I didn't, all I wanted to do was come up with a really hip and different groove. And again, it goes back to what would Stevie do? And that was the inspiration for the whole thing.
Does he know that? Does he know that you think you approach things that way?
Does Steve know?
Yeah, does he know?
I think he does.
Or did he know that he was the template for that song?
No, he didn't know it then.
Wow.
No.
So, don't stop till you get enough. Did that bridge write itself? Great. We know the song, guys. Okay. Come on.
We were giving you some background music for the conversation.
You know what, you're going to play it anyway. So.
No, but you can play it. But actually, I should have brought my little souvenir.
We found it, by the way.
You found it?
Oh,
it's okay.
Yeah.
It's a podcast. It's not visual anyway. But, you know, I have at the house, I have a 45 with both our names on it.
Yeah, we were talking about the other night.
Yeah.
Yeah, we found about after you. Okay, so backstory: Greg did me and Boss Bill's class in NYU, where he told us this story that he's about to tell, and since then, it's been my mission to find every 45 with your name on it. And I have three now.
Really?
Yeah, hell yeah. That's my obsession. Any Don't Stop Till You Get Enough with your name on the writer's credits.
Wow.
I found it. All right, so tell the story.
Okay. Well, and you know, Spike asked me to tell the story too when he did the doc for, what was it?
Off the Wall.
Off the Wall, right. And I did. And he loved it, but it
didn't make it.
The estate.
The estate said, I don't think so.
Well, the estate has no control over this show, so.
Yeah. Okay. Because the estate was like, I don't think so, cousin. I don't think so. Get a call from Mike. He wants me to come by to write a song or to hear a song to write. I go, okay. So I hop on over to Havenhurst and see him, and he plays me this thing. He says, it just needs something, it just needs another section. So I hear it, and you know, it's fantastic. I mean, you know, everything's there. It's the verse, the hook, you know, it's a cool groove. Everything's great. He says, yeah, it just needs one more section. So I go, and probably in the time that it would take you to hum the Jeopardy theme song, I came up with Q Bridge.
Ouch! Okay.
So I played that, and then I said, so what do you think? He goes, I like it. I go, yeah? He says, yeah. He says, well, cool. So now I'm thinking, okay, well, now he did ask me to come over to write, so I'm guessing I should call myself a co-writer. So I says, well, am I going to get a piece of this? He goes, yeah. I go, really? He says, yeah. I says, well, what do you think? He goes, what do you think? I go, what do you think? And so we're going back and forth on that. So now in my mind, there's another sound for what's going on in my mind that I can't, but it's just like the wheels are spinning and all this is happening in nanoseconds, right? So I'm thinking, oh my God, what do I think? What do I say? How much? 50%? No,
right.
That's too much.
What's the answer?
40? No, not quite. 35? I don't know. 25? Well, maybe. I'm not sure. 15? I don't know. So I keep talking myself down.
You talk yourself down.
I talk myself down. I talk myself. I admit it.
To what number?
So I said, well, how about 10%?
Oh, my.
That sounds fair.
I mean.
I know. But stay with me. Okay. So I says, what about 10%? He goes, okay. I go, really? He goes, yeah. I don't even know how I drove home because I'm sure I could have levitated. I'm like, so I'm just like loopy at this point, right? And I'm just so excited. Some days pass. I get something in the mail. It's a contract. Okay. Open it up. And I'm looking and I'm scrolling down. First of all, I don't even pay attention to the fact that they misspelled my last name. I don't even care. I don't even care that they used a T instead of a P. I don't care.
Wow.
I don't care.
Thilling Gaines.
TH instead of PH. Oh. Yeah. So I don't care. I get past that. It's at the top of the contract anyway. I don't care. I scroll down. I go, man. I'm looking for the punchline and I see 10%. I go, it's in there.
Okay.
It's in there. I'm in there. I am in there. So some more time passes, right? Yeah. Some more days pass. And then I got a phone call. And it's from one of Mike's managers at the time. It was either Ron Wisner or Freddie DeMann. It was probably Freddie. And he says, hey, Greg, you know that contract we sent you? I said, yes, no problem. It's on the way back to you any second now. No worries. He's like, well, not so fast. And this is where you have the sound effect for a breaking car. Like, well, that'll work too. And I go, what do you mean not so fast? He goes, well, Michael's been thinking about this. And turns out that he is determined that what you did was more of an arrangement.
Okay.
So that falls under the category of arrangement. So what we're going to do is we're just going to.
That 10% wasn't going to break Michael.
We're going to pass on that contract part. So thanks for your contribution, and we'll check back with you.
Well, what'd you get for the arrangement? I mean, what's the difference, money? Oh God.
Yeah. Well, I got a pat on the back. And Laya, see, this was my introduction to business.
Okay.
So, slight question though.
Okay.
Did you?
Because I have a lot more to say about it. But
did you? No. Let me.
Go ahead.
This is one of the times I got to interrupt. So with Destiny and Triumph. With Destiny and Triumph, were there any talks of, hey guys, can I get co-production at least, or what am I doing here? Because those sessions, you're like leading that shit.
Yeah, I know. And yes, there were, and there was an answer for that question.
No.
And there was an answer. The answer came in the form of the term associate producer. Which doesn't mean
shit. Yeah,
it doesn't mean anything. But, you know, they figured they'd just throw me half of an old bone and shut me up. That's the answer to that question. But I got to go back because, as I was saying to Elijah, my introduction to
business
and the fact that I was not only young, but of the makeup that didn't want to fight.
Yeah. Non-confrontational.
And this is the difference between me and I'd say 9 out of 10 artists in today's world, because they are freaking savvy and they don't care. Mm-hmm. And I applaud them for that. I applaud them for their business savvy and their understanding. But unfortunately, in a lot of ways, nothing has changed from what happened to me and, you know, 40 years before that in the 50s to these days, because there's still those horror stories of people just being grossly unfair for virtually no reason. And who did you said the 10% would have broken? Of course not. Yeah. That's not the issue. The issue is
the appearance.
I want it all. And the issue is but now while this is going on, while these days are passing and while the contract's in the works and before I get the phone call from Freddie, the 45, the single was already going to print. It was already being pressed. That's why you have initial copies with my name and Michael's, because even people like Quincy thought, oh man, Greg is in. He's in there, man. He was so proud of me. And then, you know, because that was the first pressing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it already went to press with my name on it, only for Michael to change his mind later on.
See, that's when we talked to Quincy. He had this kind of disposition of, yeah, that's Michael, and that was messed up, but that's Michael.
Yeah, but guess what? There's a Quincy version of that, too.
And if you want to hear that Quincy Jones story, make sure you tune in next week for part 2 of the Questlove Supreme interview with the one and only Greg Fillengate. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry to leave y'all hanging like that, but you know how it is, y'all. Make sure y'all come back next week. We'll have more treats for y'all. Also, check out the Mix Suprema, all the joints that Greg Fillengate had his hands in playing on a lot of records. We got all that there for you, all right? We'll see you on the next go-round. See ya. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.